You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
As you know, today the United States assumes the presidency of the United Nations Security Council, and we're ready to get to work.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield takes up her role as US ambassador to the UN. We'll look at what's on her agenda. Then Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French president, has been found guilty of corruption. We'll examine his crime and how this will impact on his political ambitions. Plus, we'll join our contributor in Yerevan to catch up with the latest political unrest in Armenia before hearing details of a new documentary on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist.
The scene that we shoot on that subway as Omar gets a death threat, that happened to us 20, 30 times in the filming of this movie. This wasn't a one-off. This was happening on a daily basis.
With a rustle through the papers, a roundup of business news and heartening results from a platform that supports independent bookshops, that's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. In Hong Kong, marathon hearings resumed for the 47 democracy activists charged under the Beijing-imposed national security law. The US is expected to announce sanctions on Russia over the jailing of the Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. And Volvo joins the list of car makers ditching petrol for a greener electric future. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, Linda Thomas-Greenfield began her new role as US ambassador to the United Nations yesterday. The US currently holds the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council, the organization's most powerful body. Thomas-Greenfield will run the council's meetings and announce its decisions. After her confirmation hearing, she echoed President Biden, saying, "America is back," and adding, "Multilateralism is back, diplomacy is back." But how will this manifest itself? Well, Paul Rogers is a professor of peace studies at Bradford University and an international security advisor at Open Democracy and joins me now. Paul, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about the background of Linda Thomas-Greenfield? She's a career diplomat.
Very much a career diplomat. She served 33 years in the State Department, going right almost from the bottom right through to a senior position. Her most senior position through to 2017 was actually as Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. So it covered a big area, and she'd had many other senior roles. She was one of the casualties of Trump's clear out in 2017. And for the last 4 years, she's been part of the Albright Stonebridge consultancy. The Albright is from Madeleine Albright, who's the chair, and that basically has worked with various companies, NGOs and the rest, advising on international relations. So she's a thoroughgoing State Department professional with considerable experience.
What of her famous gumbo diplomacy?
Well, that's basically saying, I mean, you know, this gumbo sauce is when you're actually doing this rather difficult cooking. If you're actually handling a conversation at the same time, it shows that, you know, you can actually handle things pretty well. It's a phrase which probably is almost unrecognizable outside the United States, but it's very much playing for a domestic audience, and it's part of this business of saying that, as you said in the intro, diplomacy is back in the United States.
Now, yesterday she spoke passionately about Yemen. What's the detail on that?
I think the detail is it's one of the biggest problems facing the United States, and it also handles makes it for difficulty because it's concerned with the Saudi relations. I think the State Department under her, well, under Blinken, of course, wants to put this as a higher priority. But the net thing is she sees this as a major issue in which the United States does have to change its position. It's a difficult one because, of course, of the Saudi role, and the State Department, indeed the Biden administration, has already come under a degree of criticism for the way that it has not been tough enough with the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia in relation to his role in the Khashoggi killing. So I think you have a problem there, but she feels that Yemen is extremely important, which of course it is. And I think this is part of a process of putting pressure on the Saudis. And incidentally, there's been a call overnight for the standing down of the Crown Prince's rather sort of unique special force, which is the sort of the elite of the elite within the Saudi armed forces.
Now, she has previously been accused of being soft on China, and it's a charge that she vociferously denies. Do you think we'll see strong action there?
Probably. I mean, the problem here is she gave a speech when she was with the Albright-Stonebridge consultancy to one of the Confucius Institutes, which is very much a Chinese government sort of group, in which people felt she wasn't as tough on China, particularly over its treatment of the Uyghurs. And of course, now we also have the problems that you've been reporting this morning in Hong Kong. She is resolute in saying that, no, they will be standing up to China. And in fact, I think she gave something approaching an apology for the tone of that particular speech. So I think she sees that as a major issue, a very difficult one for the United States, because of course China is just growing in economic power week by week, if not day by day. It's recovered from COVID so quickly that in fact China is now an even bigger player on the world stage than it was.
Now, the Myanmar ambassador to the UN gave an impassioned plea to the body recently. How is that likely to be handled at Security Council level?
Well, there will be discussions. The problem with Myanmar is that essentially China really is pulling the strings. And this is why China is a particular difficulty for the United States. The Myanmar ambassador, of course, promptly lost his job. And I think the issue here is whether she can actually move things sufficiently on the Security Council for strongly worded statements to come out. It won't be more than that because of the role of China. And as one of the four or five permanent members, of course, it does actually have a veto.
Now, as you said, she has a great deal of experience in Africa. I think she's been ambassador to Liberia and various other places. Might we see the continent taking up much more discussion time as a consequence?
Well, there's some indication of that in that basically she wants to sort of bring to the fore. You mentioned Yemen, but she's also wanting to focus on the crisis in Ethiopia, where you have what is amounting to almost a civil war. You have hundreds of thousands of people in Tigray who've been internally displaced, and many tens of thousands have actually already fled to Sudan. And now that you have this conflict between the federal army and the forces who were loyal to what was called the Tigray People's Liberation Front, really an offshoot of what the previous government was, that's now been outlawed, and so you have this very bitter conflict. That is one area where I think she will do her best to ensure that the United States does put pressure on the government to try and find some way out of it, because it's rapidly becoming a really major disaster. So I think you're going to see a bigger role, but obviously with her huge experience on US diplomacy in Africa, you would expect that. But that, of course, leaves aside the two other big issues facing the State Department and, of course, the Pentagon to an extent, and that, of course, is Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's early days to see what the US attitude will be there within the United Nations. But Afghanistan in particular is going to be extremely difficult, given you have this supposed deadline in May for the withdrawal of all US troops.
I mean, generally, how do you feel that she'll set the tone for US diplomacy under the new administration?
One of the interesting things was she gave an interview last night to CNN, and she made it clear that one of her jobs was to try and reassert American diplomatic leadership after the shock of the events in the Capitol, which is only one, not even 2 months. And she made the point in that interview, made two points. One, that it showed that the United States does have resilience, and she points out that in fact Congress reasserted itself, went back that same day and sat through the night to complete the legislation. And she also points to the fact that 300 people have been indicted. So she will try and push as far as she can that the United States is restored to where it should be in the Democrat view, in marked contrast to Trump and in marked contrast to the chaos that you had back in January.
How much power does the role actually have?
Not a great deal of power, and there's not a particular power. It's, in a way, I suppose, a baptism of fire for her that the first day at work, and she was only confirmed a week or so ago, her first day at work was actually to put her as the presidency of the Security Council. I think what you will see is a degree of influence and status, but there isn't a huge amount of power because it's just part of a very big system, although of course she is on the National Security Council. I think it'll be really very much a case of the diplomatic back here and we're doing it professionally, and she'll try slowly to restore US prestige, which has been really very badly damaged by those events at the end of the Trump era.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. That was Paul Rogers there. Nicolas Sarkozy, the former president of France, has been sentenced to jail for corruption. Sarkozy served 1 5-year term as the French leader from 2007, losing to the socialist François Hollande in 2012. Well, journalist and author Agnès Poirier covered the trial for us, and she's back to talk us through the sentencing. Good morning to you, Agnès.
Good morning.
Do you remind us of Sarkozy's crime? What was he accused of?
So he's accused of, I quote the judge yesterday, a serious and concurring evidence of collaboration between his lawyer and a senior magistrate to break the law. Basically, it's a case of corruption and influence peddling. You'll have to follow me very closely, because we found out about this case during an investigation about something else and a case that was later dropped. Nicolas Sarkozy at the time was investigated for illicit or donations from the cosmetic giant L'Oréal and the heiress of L'Oréal, Mrs. Bettencourt. So that case was dropped. But during that investigation, the mobile phones of Nicolas Sarkozy and his lawyer were tapped, and French detectives undertook a conversation during which Nicolas Sarkozy's lawyer contacted a senior magistrate in order to get some information about that Bettencourt case in exchange for a very nice position for the magistrate in the south of France. Therefore, the case and the sentencing yesterday for corruption and influence peddling.
Mm. I understand he's appealed, though. So what happens next?
Yes, he's appealed because of probably the rather severity of the sentencing. And that's really the crux of the matter, because, you know, Nicolas Sarkozy wrote a book that has been a bestseller in France called The Time of Storms, in which he really depicts himself as a long-suffering victim of a vendetta, if you'd like, by left-wing investigating judges, who's been hunting down for years. And there's a rising, you know, music in France, and people are starting to feel sympathy for him, because indeed it's been going on for a long time. And there are other investigations against Nicolas Sarkozy. There's another one, for instance, concerning his overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. So it is true that there are a lot of investigations being carried out against Nicolas Sarkozy. So I think for the sake of the whole country, it would be good if all those cases, you know, draw to a conclusion one way or another, and that Nicolas Sarkozy serves his time not in prison. It looks as if he will be able to have a electronic tag and be confined to his home, because, as you said, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but only two suspended.
Mm. Has a French president ever been convicted before?
Well, yes, there was President Jacques Chirac. So that was a different case in the sense that there was no custodial sentence. He was sentenced to 2 years, but suspended. And also for a case, for a rather old case that brought us back to the 1980s and 1990s, when President Jacques Chirac at the time was not president, but the mayor of Paris. And that was for sort of systemic use of fake or ghost jobs. And that was something that was actually practiced by a lot of political parties, because at the time there was no law regulating the financing of political parties. So that's how they all operated, more or less, by giving ghost jobs to people. And that's how they got their party financed. So there's a precedent, but Nicolas Sarkozy would be the first French president of the Fifth Republic to get a custodial sentence.
Mm. So how's the country reacted?
Well, it was a shock, you know. Imagine a head of state to be given such a severe sentence. Yes, I think the court fell completely silent and was probably quite stunned. It was a historic moment yesterday. So this is no case, you know, for rejoicing, although it's always good when justice is being done. Now, the question, I think, rising in France is whether it's fair. No doubt Nicolas Sarkozy tried to obtain some information from a senior magistrate about an investigation on him, but now is the sentence, severe enough, or perhaps too severe?
Mm. Now, he didn't actually comment, but his wife, Carla Bruni, did. She put out an Instagram post.
Yes, she did, with a romantic picture of them embracing, and I think she said the truth will out, but what senseless harassment. And this is really what him and his party has been saying for years. And, you know, I'm no fan of Nicolas Sarkozy at all, but, the sooner all this is done and he appeals and we get the answer from the justice, the better, because the Financial Crimes Prosecutor's Office, from where all those investigations are coming, is a highly contested office in the French judiciary, even within that office. And, you know, we want to believe that the justice system is fair for everyone.
Mm. But as you say, I mean, this is likely to drag on for a long time. There are other crimes. He's on trial again next month. And the appeal, I mean, could that take years?
Yeah, at least, yes. So in the end, the question, because, you know, the French right has been without a strong leader for years now. And so his if he had any hopes of returning to public life, well, that was quashed yesterday. So the French right will have to seek another candidate they need to hurry. The next presidential elections is next year.
Mm, and so that's really it for his political future.
It looks like it.
Agnes, thanks very much indeed. That's Agnes Poirier. Still to come on the programme, political crisis in Armenia, a turn up for the books for independent retailers, plus...
The scene that we shoot on that subway as Omar gets a death threat, that happened to us 20, 30 times in the filming of this movie. This wasn't a one-off. This was happening on a daily basis.
We hear from an Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker, Brian Fogel. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Monocle's free to subscribe daily email newsletters, the Monocle Minute and Weekend Edition, deliver headlines and a swathe of recommendations from our editors, correspondents and bureau. You can also browse a menu of radio highlights and Monocle films. While the focus is on news and comment during the week, our weekend newsletters deliver great columns from Andrew Tuck on Saturdays and Tyler Brulé on Sundays. Cultural highs, media diets and far-off newspapers, recipes to cook at home. It's a fun take on weekend living. Head to monocle.com/minute to be part of the conversation.
Armenia has been mired in a political crisis since the war with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region ended in November. The unrest has escalated recently, with protesters demonstrating on the streets as the Prime Minister clashed with the President over the dismissal of the army chief. Ani Mejlumian, senior correspondent at Eurasianet, based in Yerevan, is on the line now. Ani, can you take us back to November the 10th, when Russia brokered a peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan? What was the immediate aftermath of the war that saw thousands killed on both sides?
Hello. So after November 10th, of course, there were protests. People marched into government buildings, into prime minister residence. But since then, I mean, due to certain events, the protests seem to be a little bit settled down. But they started again on February.
And why?
Partially, these recent developments, which I would like to talk about, because these seem a little bit more serious and it could actually take the protest to some sort of conclusion, in my opinion. It's because the army made an unprecedented statement. So military got involved in politics, made a political statement, asked Pashinyan, the prime minister, to resign. The statement read that they have tolerated this government enough, the government that tried to discredit the generals and the army for years, and whatever decisions the government is making is putting Armenia in a very difficult position in terms of internal and also foreign politics. Mm-hmm. This statement was signed by over 40 high-ranking military people, including many generals and also the chief of staff of armed forces, which is the highest military ranking position in Armenia. So army is one of the most respected, highest respected institutes in Armenia. At the same time, this seemed very serious to Pashinyan as well. So immediately he goes out and he calls it a military coup attempt, and he hastily organizes a rally, which is answered by the opposition, which is over 17 political parties, and all the major political parties, opposition parties in Armenia. And they started organizing rallies as well. What I want to mention is that these rallies, whether Pashinyan is gathering the people or the opposition, they do not collect many people. They do not gather many people. So it's like they say 20,000 here, 10,000 there. So at the same time, I don't think people are really responding to these rallies in a way. But we're looking at social media, talking to people. They're really interested in what's going on. A lot of them want to resign. I recently just came back from Nagorno-Karabakh. The situation there also seems very anti-Pashinyan. So it's really hard to say where this is going to take us. But what we know for sure that this army statement was unprecedented. Pashinyan feels very threatened. Now he needs the president to sign the resignation of Oleg Gasparyan, which is his new nemesis, apparently. And Oleg Gasparyan is the head of armed forces. But Armen Sarkisyan, the president of Armenia, who has the constitutional right to dismiss or to sign this decree by the prime minister, has refused to do it so far. And Pashinyan right now is going against Armen Sarkisyan, trying to negotiate with him, but at the same time trying to push him to sign this document and dismiss the head of armed forces. Maybe he thinks this is going to solve the issue. My personal opinion is it is not going to, since that statement wasn't signed just by Oleg Gasparyan himself, but basically almost all high-ranking military people.
So, I mean, could it in fact actually lead to a real coup?
It is hard to say at the moment, because for right now there are no signs of it, even though I think Pashinyan is a little bit trying to exaggerate the situation in a way, because he says he has facts that Serge Sargsyan, the former president, is pressuring, motivating the army to go against the people. His precise words were crush democracy under the tanks. and trying that way to pump up people, you know, to gather more people, as if it's going to be another March 1st, you know, back in 2008, when there was violent breakup of protests and 10 people died. And Pashinyan was one of the opposition leaders leading those rallies. So like yesterday, it was the anniversary of that day, a commemoration, and Pashinyan went on stage and he said just not for the sake of highlighting the symbolism, but I just want to mention that this is like something very similar. This is what they want to do. They want to crush democracy under the tanks. But at the same time, I think the situation is very, very different. They are not the opposition. They are the government now. And from what we see right now, what from Pashinyan words I understand, the army is completely out of his control, because army does answer to the head of armed forces. And of course, according to constitution, during the war, prime minister is leading the army. He's the commander general of the army. But in general, Pashinyan is not a military person. So I don't think like he has lots of respect. And from what we see in military, don't think he has any influence. But at the same time, he failed to produce any evidence that this army unprecedented involvement in politics is has been pushed by former president, President Robert Kocharyan or Serzh Sargsyan, well, which could be the case. But I mean, for now, we don't really have any evidence of that. So one way or another, I think if Pashinyan continues, he doesn't resign, and maybe some other events are going to unfold. As we see this, November 10th deal is not really working in Armenia's favor in any way. And we don't see also the Armenian government trying to get better deals, even if it's about like a small border here, a small border there. So people continue getting angry on stuff like that. So we don't know. This might unfold into something very serious. It also might die down because Pashinyan said, let's do snap elections. But as we know, he talked about snap elections in December, and he backed down from it on February. So we don't know. I think a lot of it depends on how Pashinyan is going to take this matters to his hands, how he's going to deal with this. If there is snap elections, I think this military so-called coup attempt is not going to happen. But if it doesn't, there is no way of being sure.
As you say, that the rallies weren't particularly well attended. What do the people of Armenia really want?
It is hard to say, because people are in shock, both in Armenia and in Nagorno-Karabakh. In Nagorno-Karabakh, they live, you know, day by day. They don't really see any future prospects. This was my impression. When we come to Armenia, people are still in shock, because this is a small country. Everybody had somebody in war. Something happened. I think people also do not have much trust in the former regimes, and they feel like former regime figureheads former regime like itself is going to come to politics again. And people also do not want Pashinyan, because they think his government is incapable of making Armenia a better place, or dealing with this gripping political crisis itself. I think the society is pretty much split. People who don't want Pashinyan, but at the same time, they do not want the former regime. This is very hard to say. What do they want? I think they would really want a new leader, somebody who has no connections to the former regime, somebody who has no connections to the current one. But for now, we don't see a candidate like that. And I don't think a candidate like that going to come around anytime soon.
Annie, thank you very much indeed. That's Annie Mejlumian. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. In Hong Kong, hearings resumed for the 47 democracy activists charged with conspiracy to commit subversion under the Beijing-imposed national security law. The activists are accused of organising and participating in an unofficial primary poll to select the strongest candidates for a subsequently postponed Legislative Council election last July. Authorities said the informal poll was part of a plan to overthrow the government. Last night's proceedings extended beyond midnight, with three defendants taken to hospital. The United States is expecting to impose sanctions to punish Russia for the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny as early as today. President Joe Biden's decision to impose sanctions for Navalny's poisoning will reflect a harder stance than that taken by his predecessor, Donald Trump. It's not yet clear which individuals will be targeted or what other sanctions may be imposed. And finally, the future of petrol hangs in the balance. Chinese-owned Swedish car makers Volvo have announced that their entire car lineup will be fully electric by 2030, joining a growing number of car makers planning to phase out fossil fuel engines. Last month, Ford Motor Company also said its lineup in Europe will be fully electric by 2030, while Jaguar Land Rover said its luxury Jaguar brand will be entirely electric by 2025. Car makers are racing to switch to zero-emission models as they face CO2 emissions targets in Europe and China. Now, late last week, the United States released a declassified intelligence report into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi national and Washington Post columnist who was killed inside Saudi Arabia's Istanbul consulate in 2018. To nobody's great surprise, the report laid substantial blame for Khashoggi's death upon Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. US President Joe Biden has signalled that he intends to take a tougher line on MBS. Should he seek further reason for doing so, he need look no further than The Dissident, a new documentary on Khashoggi's life and death by the Oscar-winning director Brian Fogel. Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller spoke to Brian earlier. He began by asking how he'd secured the cooperation of Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz.
You know, that comes in trust building, right? And I would like to tell you, oh, had Icarus not happened, I could have gained access to this story. Had I not had the honor of winning an Academy Award, I would have been able to do this. And the truth is that coming into this story, here was every journalist or filmmaker trying to gain this access and trust. And I think that my past work of protecting a whistleblower's life, dealing with such sensitive subject matter, really becoming an activist and taking a very, very active role in that story, lent trust to Hatice. And then, you know, I flew to Istanbul and I didn't bring cameras. I wasn't, you know, coming there and going, hey, we're going to shoot. I came there just to meet her and for us to establish a friendship. And I ended up staying in Istanbul during the first trip for 5 weeks. And this was really starting in just a month after Jamal's murder. And we would get together and just, you know, essentially cry. And I just said to her, look, this is terrible. And I cannot fathom, I cannot believe, I can't even begin to comprehend what you're going through. But if you let me into your world, if you let me capture this moment in time, and I think I can help you heal. And I think I can help you have some closure for this. And I think that I can see to it that Jamal has a legacy preserved in regards to your love for him and what this really means. And I left there after being there for 5 weeks. And about a month later, you know, we were still in daily communication. She said, look, I'm ready. I want to do this. And I met her in Brussels, Belgium, as she went to go speak in front of the European Parliament for the first time in February 2019. And we began on this journey. And I'm in touch with her almost every day.
The Dissident tells Khashoggi's story, obviously, but it does also, I think, demonstrate very well what he represented or may yet represent, which I guess is another form of his legacy. And that seems to be personified in the figure of Omar Abdulaziz, who's another young activist blogger who was an associate of Khashoggi's. And again, somebody who is running extraordinary risks to try and broadcast his view of what he would like Saudi Arabia to become. Again, how did you make contact with him and how were you able to win him over?
You know, it's a similar situation as I had with Hatice. I made contact with Omar at the time through Thor Halvorsen and the Human Rights Foundation that had come in to back the project. Thor had been reaching out to Omar. He had invited him to attend the Oslo Freedom Forum, which Jamal attended months before his death in Oslo, which is an annual event where the Human Rights Foundation brings together basically dissidents, activists from all over the world that are living under oppressive authoritarian regimes or governments and they bring them together to talk and share ideas and tell their stories of what is going on in their country. And Omar had been on Thor's radar for quite some time because of his Twitter account. And, you know, this was before Jamal's murder. And in the fallout of Jamal's murder, a story broke in the New York Times with Omar coming forward and going, hey, I think I know why Jamal was killed. Obviously, we get into great detail in that, in the film. So I made that connection. And Omar invited me to Montreal. And in the case of Omar, he was very concerned about participating too. He wasn't ready. He himself was grieving. And we decided, he said, okay, you can film with me because I know what's going on, that there's, you know, time and stuff, but I'm not ready. So what we did with Omar is for the first 6 months that we filmed together, then I was traveling back and forth between Istanbul and Montreal, we would leave Omar the camera cards after every day that we would shoot with him, because he wasn't ready, didn't know if he wanted to do this. And I think that doing that built this extraordinary trust between us, because he understood that he was in control and that he was in control of his own story. And I think that that ultimately allowed us to work with an extraordinary amount of trust, because he saw that I was there, I was patient, I wasn't pushing. I was there to work with him on his timeline when he was ready.
While you were filming, and I guess since the film's been completed, were you aware of any contact whatsoever from Saudi authorities, who obviously can't have been delighted by the project?
I have not felt that we were ever under threat. We were advised, like when we were working with Hatice in London, I got a notification, in fact, that she was being monitored by the Saudis. She had moved to London. They knew that she was in London. And apparently they had active surveillance surrounding her. Omar, on many, many, many days of our shooting together, we were not able to shoot because he had received a credible threat. And the Canadian authorities were telling him, look, you just need to stay quiet, be with us. And he did. So, you know, this was an ongoing daily situation as we were filming. As threats were coming in, we were being privy to access to understand how real this is and was. I mean, the scene that we shoot on that subway as Omar gets a death threat, that happened to us 20, 30 times in the filming of this movie. This wasn't a one-off. This was happening on a daily basis in regards to the production. And our choice to start the film as we come and find him coming into the Hotel Elizabeth in Montreal. He was living in that hotel for 6 months because Canadian intelligence put him in that hotel after Jamal's murder, because they could protect him. And in that hotel, they could have officers living in rooms next to him. They could monitor traffic in and out. And so the choice even to start the film like that, in that thriller kind of mode, where you have this, you know, young dissident in a hotel room by himself, speaking about, you know, revenge, was not only setting the stakes for the emotional feeling and that I wanted the film to feel like a thriller and crafted as a thriller, that was all real.
And that was Brian Fogel, director of The Dissident, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me on the line is journalist and communications consultant Simon Brook. Good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning.
We're going to start with the FT, and this is the whole vaccination debacle. What I particularly enjoy about the article that you've chosen to focus on is its description of goings-on in the German parliament and what Olaf Scholz, the finance minister, said.
Yes, absolutely. As the paper points out, normally cabinet ministers in Germany are very sort of sedate affairs, but there has been a lot of upset here. I won't use the phrase he uses.
Oh, I think you should.
Okay, well, as we say in German politics, it's the European Commission vaccination strategy has been a total shit show, and that sort of sets the tone for the piece, really. Just looking at the record of the European Commission, but in particular focusing on the President, Ursula von der Leyen, And the paper makes the point that, of course, she put herself very much at the centre of the campaign across the EU to get vaccinations going. I mean, I suppose the question the paper's posing is, was this a mistake given how badly things have turned out? And the article goes on to explore the options and question what it means for Andrea von der Leyen. There are plenty of examples, as well as the swearing in the German cabinet meeting there. The paper points out the Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and the Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of going to Jerusalem to see how they've done it. Meanwhile, Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia have either bought or are thinking of buying Russian or Chinese vaccines, which are not actually authorised by the EU's regulator. So really a sort of summary of the mess that the EU and therefore Andrea von der Leyen is in over this situation.
I mean, I think it's concerning, isn't it, that Viktor Orban's Hungary is going to buy Russian or Chinese vaccines?
Yeah, this is a split we've seen, haven't we, between the sort of the populists, if you like, within the EU. Certainly, Orban has always made his fondness for Russia clear. And so on the one side, we've got him and his colleagues, the Visegrad countries. And then on the other hand, we've got the West, whatever. But as the paper, the FT points out as well, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron were very critical of AstraZeneca, and that they seem to have softened their line slightly, but it's one of the things that arguably has caused so many problems for the EU.
Yeah. Let's move on to the Washington Post, which is in its opinion column, looking at Myanmar.
Yes, absolutely. So the question here, as Myanmar's coup leaders turn to massacres, the US response must be forceful, argues the Washington Post editorial board. Well, what's forceful mean is the question that a lot of us will be asking. The paper reminds us that the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has denounced the what he called abhorrent violence on Sunday and has sanctioned several senior officials. But what the WashPo goes on to argue is that this actually has to go further, and that the administration should sanction Myanmar companies who are working with Western partners, so that those Western partners and the banks that are funding them could be blocked from remitting funds to them. So I suppose this is an indication, perhaps very early in the Biden administration, of just how interventionist it plans to be.
Let's go to France now, where, of course, the country's reeling at the sentence handed out to Nicolas Sarkozy. And Le Monde talks about how Macron wants to demonise his opponents in order to capture the moderate electorate.
Yeah, in other news, as we might say, yes, certainly Le Monde is full of reports on the Sarkozy situation. But Emmanuel Macron, who's planning, of course, for the presidential election next year, is attacking people that he considers to be extremes. That's radical judges, that's Greens, certainly Marine Le Pen, who is his biggest rival for the presidency next year, the extreme right wing leader. The idea, according to sources talking to Le Monde, is that people will realise that almost everybody is. Well, it's a way of appealing to the sort of the centre moderate electorate, according to the paper. And there's an example here of the Macron supporters criticising the mayor of Lyon, who's introduced a meatless menu in local schools. So this is a way of getting at the EELV, which is the Green Party grouping, which has done very well both in the 2019 European elections and then more recently in the municipal elections after that.
And finally, the Golden Globes, which of course were virtual this year.
They were indeed. I have to say, personally, I find nothing more boring and pointless and tacky than the Golden Globes, but then they are a celebration of tackiness, aren't they? But yes, the Times, well, actually the Guardian, many other papers do it as well, just looking at what people are wearing, given that they're not, as you say, on the red carpet, they are in their living rooms or whatever. So various people who, John Boyega, who won the Best Supporting Actor in a TV series for his role in Small Axe, apparently he looked immaculate in a cream tuxedo jacket and white shirt, but revealing during his acceptance speech that he was actually wearing tracksuit bottoms on his lower half. And why shouldn't he, after all? Interesting. Also, sofas get a look in. So the award for the best dressed sofa goes to the one owned by Olivia Colman. And this is a little mustard velvet number with a matching pouf and fluffy cream cushion. So I think this is a trend that could continue.
And I love the fact that Gillian Anderson, who looked fantastic in sort of golds and bronze, also had her dog in a matching bow.
Yeah, exactly. So she has done what quite a few of the award winners did, which is basically to imagine that she was on the red carpet, even though she's sitting at home. And yes, exactly. And the one thing that this has allowed various winners and others to do, as you say, is to bring their dogs along, because according to the papers, there are quite a lot of appearances by the best dressed pooches as well. So again, another trend that we might see continue.
Possibly. Simon Brook, thanks very much indeed. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and it's time to talk business now with the financial analyst Louise Cooper. Good morning to you, Louise.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, we've been following this story about Volvo, who say that they're going to aim to make only electric cars by 2030. You've got some more detail on that.
Yes. So, I mean, the quote from the chief executive, "I am totally convinced there will be no customers who really want to stay with a petrol engine." This is only 9 years' time. This is not very long into the future. "We are convinced," he goes on, "that an electric car is more attractive for consumers." And it's not just Volvo. If you look at the companies that have made this sort of announcement, it's astonishing how quickly the traditional old car industry has caught up with Tesla. You've got Ford saying its sales in Europe will be fully electric by 2030. You've got Bentley, very posh car maker, saying its models all electric by 2030. There's just a whole load of companies saying the same. Now, the really interesting point about this is, first of all, Tesla has shown them how they do it. So the first thing Volvo are saying is, "We're going to sell them online only." Well, think of all the car dealerships there are in Europe. I mean, I can think of about 10 within about 5 mile radius of me here in where I live in southwest London. So online only, which is what Tesla does. Volvo's also saying wireless upgrades and fixes for new electric models. Again, same sort of thing that Tesla do. The other massive implication that for this is that currently there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs in Europe in the car industry. Well, a lot of those will go because there are far less moving parts. There are no engines, there are no oil filters, there are no fuel injectors, there are no spark plugs. You know, an electric car is an awful lot more simpler than a traditional car. Absolutely, it's got a massive, massive, massive battery, but that's not really where these old-fashioned car makers' strengths lay. I mean, is it? It's like Apple has that brilliance and Tesla has that brilliance. So, you know, there are millions and millions of jobs in Europe that will go, and it will go in the next 9 years. I don't think this is something that people have really woken up to yet.
No, it's got huge implications, hasn't it? Let's cross to the Asian stock markets and have a look at what's going on there.
Yeah, a little bit of a fall. So one of the things that's been quite astonishing is, given the scale of the economic carnage that COVID has wreaked around the world, is that global stock markets are at record levels, driven particularly by America. And overnight, we've had a senior Chinese official talk about and raise the risk of these asset bubbles in foreign markets. I mean, he says this is the head of China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission. So he's a regulator, right? And his job is to look at the risks in the financial system and say where they are. And he said financial markets are trading at high levels in Europe, the US and other developed countries, which runs counter to the real economy. And he thinks this is a risk to China. Now, I would argue there are massive asset bubbles in the Chinese economy. Quite why he isn't pointing those out, I think, is probably because of political reasons. But the other thing is that, you know, the stock market is not the economy. And this is something I've argued for a very long time. And again, maybe the financial sophistication of somebody coming from a communist state isn't that great. But the stock market is not the economy. And one could well argue, for example, in NASDAQ, the tech has in NASDAQ, you know, tech companies have done incredibly well out of COVID. It's no surprise their shares have done very well.
Absolutely. And one of those companies, of course, is Zoom.
So everyone's waiting, right, for when we get back to normal. Okay, we're all going to return to the office. Everything's going to go back to normal, and we're going to just forget COVID has changed. So this is, or how much do we return to normal? Do we always work from home a bit now? You know what? Because this is a huge shift in society, and I'm moving from side to side as I say this, Georgina. And how much do we sort of revert back to, you know, to normal? How much do we actually, you know, stay with some of the behavioural things that have changed us? And what Zoom said last night is actually they're expecting, of course, not such a record year in 2020. 2021 was extraordinary. They increased their revenue threefold. You know, they Zoom boomed. Of course it did. But they're actually saying, you know, we expect 2022 to be a really good year as well. We expect revenue to continue to grow, not at the levels it grew last year, but to continued growth at something like 40-odd%. And I think this is quite an interesting opinion from Zoom. I mean, clearly that's what they must be seeing, that working from home is here to stay. You know, and I find myself, to be honest, now that I've got so used to video calls, when I'm at home and I've got Wi-Fi, I do default now to video calls rather than phone calls because I've got Wi-Fi and it's kind of nice to see people's faces. Interestingly, the BBC did a hilarious interview with the boss of Canary Wharf, which is a massive office development, tower block office development in East London for a lot of financial firms. And the headline with that is people are getting tired of working from home. Well, that's called talking your own book. If you own a massive office block, huge office blocks in East London, you want people to get back to the office. Otherwise, the people that you rent those office blocks to may well turn around and say, we only need half the space we previously did. So there you go. And a hilarious example of talking your own book, the boss of Canary Wharf saying people are tired of working from home.
Absolutely. Louise, thank you very much indeed. That is Louise Cooper joining us on Zoom, I presume. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Bookshop.org is an online bookselling platform and affiliate network with a mission to financially support independent bookstores and literary culture. The platform first launched in the USA in January 2020 and has already raised over $10 million for independent bookshops in the States. Bookshop began in the UK in November 2020 and has announced that it's generated £1 million for independent bookshops in just 4 months. Nicole Vanderbilt is the Managing Director at Bookshop UK and she joins me now. Nicole, it's lovely to speak to you again. This is tremendous news. Did you imagine that taking on the big boys of online shopping could be so successful? I mean, without the rapid turnaround or the bargain prices of Amazon, how did you manage it?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I think bookshop.org is at this intersection of these two really big trends. One is people buying more things online. You know, this was happening before the pandemic, but the pandemic has accelerated that trend. And then also a really helpful trend that people realize that where they spend their money actually really matters. And I think the pandemic has also accentuated people's sense of how important their local communities are and their local high streets are. And so when we could step in and say, you can actually, you know, spend online, but also do it in a thoughtful way, I think it just seemed to really resonate.
Mm. So how does bookshop.org work?
Yeah, so independent bookshops come and set up a profile on our website, not dissimilar to the way they would with Twitter or Instagram. Literally takes, you know, about the same amount of time and about the same amount of technical knowledge. And then anytime they sell a book through our website, they get a 30% commission of the cover price. When that order is placed, however, we take that order and pass it straight to our wholesale partner, Gardeners. And what they do is they take the book from their warehouse, put it in a piece of recycled cardboard, and send it direct to the customer's house. So what it means for an independent bookshop is they get that 30% of the cover price without any of the hassle or the operations required to get it to your home.
And often those retailers are too small to really have any kind of meaningful online presence, or at least an e-commerce site themselves.
Yes, there were quite a few bookshops that didn't offer e-commerce before the pandemic. And I think what we've heard over the last couple of months while we've been in operation is even those who did operate in e-commerce really realized how difficult it was. So, you know, those of you who are indie bookshop enthusiasts, you will have seen on social media and in news stories that they were going to heroic lengths to, you know, bike the books themselves, or, you know, were standing in line at the post office. And part of what bookshop.org, you know, the way I like to think about it is we want to provide a set of tools so that booksellers can focus on the part of their jobs that they love. Mm. And so we want them reading books and talking to customers and making recommendations, not necessarily, you know, with packing tape or in line at the post office. So we're hoping that our model enables that.
And so, yes, that is a very important part. Tell me about the human element and how that translates to the online presence.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I think a lot of times people think about technology as being this thing that's going to take over and replace humans. But my experience at bookshop.org and I was at Etsy before this, I think, is that there's a way that we can use technology in the service of humans and to sort of scalably show people the humanness of so much of commerce. And so on bookshop.org, what we allow booksellers to do, or what we provide them a tool to do, is curate lists. So you won't see, you know, a list of bestsellers on our site. What you'll see is the recommendations from individual booksellers put into lists that people can browse. So, you know, everybody can find a way into books that suits them rather than there being this convergence to only the hits.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you've done a survey of the many independent bookshops who use the platform. What kind of feedback are you getting?
Yeah, the feedback has been largely really positive. You know, we've heard these great anecdotal stories of people being able to pay their rent or have the confidence to renew a lease during a very difficult time, or offer staff Christmas bonuses in a year that seemed impossible. So, you know, we've heard a lot of really positive feedback. I think also the booksellers having these lists to create that I was just talking about has given them something that they enjoy to do in a way to kind of approximate hand selling in a digital world.
Mm-hmm. And I know that some publishers have contributed to your success by foregoing their commission.
That's right. Yeah, we spoke to lots of publishers. We've been, you know, really grateful and fortunate the degree to which the industry has embraced the platform. And a lot of the publishers said to us, well, this is so great. We don't necessarily want to be making more money from this ourselves. We'd like to make sure that we can pass on the value that's generated to the bookshop. So their 10% commission is going into a shared profit pool that all of the independents on our platform benefit from.
It's such a great, great initiative. Just finally, how do you rank yourself alongside Amazon? Obviously, you're much smaller, but in terms of, I'm guilty of using Amazon because of the speed and the ease, but you're pretty much catching up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth saying that Amazon do what they do very well, and they are very focused on just that, you know, fast and cheap. But we're really fortunate in the UK that it's, you know, the Royal Mail is affordable and reliable, and we're a relatively small country. So if you come to bookshop.org and buy a book, you'll get it, if it's in stock, within 2 to 3 days. That's not that much longer to wait than an Amazon delivery. And in terms of prices, we offer a 7% discount across the board. So on some really big new celebrity cookbooks, for example, we will not be very competitive. But that approach is competitive across a wider range of titles, and we certainly haven't seen it holding people back from buying on the site.
Nicole, thanks very much indeed. That was Nicole Vanderbilt of bookshop.org. So you know where to go next time you need to make a book purchase. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Carlotta Ribello and Paige Reynolds, our researcher Charlie Filmercourt and our studio manager Christy Evans. After the headlines, I'll be with you on the continental shift until the briefing, which will be live at midday in London time. Lots of great music before then. I can assure you we'll be dancing to it here in the studio. The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.